Jesus told his disciples there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and he asked him, "What's this I hear about you? Give an account of your management because you can't be my manager any longer." The manager said to himself, "What shall I do now? My master's taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses." So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, "How much do you owe my master?" 900 gallons of olive oil," he replied. The manager told him, "Take your bill, sit down quickly, make it 450. Then he asked the second one, "How much do you owe?" 1,000 bushels of wheat," he replied. He said, "Take your bill, make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it's gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much, and whoever is dishonest with very little will be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." This is the word of the Lord. I asked my wife this week if we were doing okay financially. She said, "Yeah, I think so. Why?" I said, "Well, I just wondered if times were tough. I see that we're filling the bottles of hand soap with water to stretch the last bit of soap in the bottle. Not just at one sink, 3 different sinks in our house. If you want to get the last little bit of soap out, you unscrew the top and slosh some water in there, and you can keep washing your hands. That way you make sure you get all the soap you paid for, right?" So this all made me wonder whether we were worse off financially than I thought. But she said, "No, we're okay." Now, I'm making fun of my dear wife here, but I do the same thing in other ways. When I take our dog Molly for walks, I frequently go for a walk on the golf course just so I can look for golf balls along the edge of the woods. Often I can find 10 or 20 golf balls on a single walk. And I'm embarrassed to admit how much joy this brings me. And when I play golf with someone who opens a brand new sleeve of golf balls that they've purchased, these balls are about $2 a piece, they place that $2 brand new ball on the tee, I'm secretly hoping that they smack that thing right into the woods so I can find it later. Now, maybe you don't lengthen the life of your hand soap or collect other people's golf balls. Maybe it's something else for you. Some people wash out and reuse Ziploc bags, I've heard. Some people wash their own cars or change their own oil because they don't want to pay somebody else to do it. Some people are bad tippers. We could multiply the examples of the ways that we save. But no matter the flavor of your own personal hang-ups regarding money, most of us, on some level, are worried that we might not have enough. Or we think that we'd be much happier if only we had a little more. With just a little more money, we'd feel safer, we'd feel more secure, we could breathe deeply, we could be more relaxed. Now, maybe there have been times in your life when you really had to worry whether there was enough food to eat for you and your family. Maybe there were times when you worried whether you had enough gas in your tank to get where you needed to go. Maybe you worried, like lots of other people, whether you'll be able to pay the bills next month, or whether you have enough to help your kids go to college, or whether you have enough saved so that you can retire. I'm not belittling these worries. These are real worries. But that saving side, that penny-pinching side, that's only one side of this problematic relationship we can have with money and wealth. On the other side of this, some of us spend too much. We spend money to entertain ourselves, to distract ourselves. We stave off boredom by shopping. We keep acquiring things we don't even need. Even after we've run out of room, I hear the storage business is booming. Now, just like being addicted to saving, we can also be addicted to spending. There's a kind of life that just can't ever imagine getting off that roller coaster of getting, buying, spending, acquiring, storing, and then running around that circle again. Like theologian Walter Brueggemann says, what we possess can end up possessing us if we're not careful. Now, all these different kinds of worries about money, I think these are things that are unavoidable for us. Having these worries doesn't make us sinful or unfaithful or greedy people. But there is a blunt and difficult conversation that we all need to have together. According to Jesus, the biggest obstacle to staying on the path, to staying on the path to which God has called all of us, the biggest obstacle is the love of money. So when we talk about staying on the path, learning to walk in Jesus' way, we have to talk together about how the love of money can distort our lives, can bend our desires, and twist us away from the abundant life to which Jesus calls us as his friends and his disciples. Now, about this parable, I'm just going to go ahead and admit that I don't fully get this. I'm not sure I understand the parable we read today from Luke 16. It's tricky. Here we have a story about a dishonest employee who loses his job. And at the end of the story, Jesus says to his followers, "Now go be like this guy." What? Why is Jesus teaching us to imitate the manager who got fired for being a cheat in the first place, and then when he got caught, selfishly looked out for his own interests when he decided how to remedy the situation? An odd parable. So back up for a minute. Let's take a running start at the parable. There's a rich man who has lots of people in his debt. The rich man employs a manager or a steward who's his bill collector. We're not told how the manager gets compensated. We don't know what his package, what the agreement is. Maybe he's paid a flat fee for his work. Maybe he earns an agreed on percentage of what he can collect. Maybe he cooks the books a little and sometimes even skims more for himself than he's supposed to. We don't really know. All we know is that the rich man has heard somehow that the manager is wasting, squandering his money. And while it is hearsay, he says, "Here's what I've heard about you," the manager doesn't appear to protest at all when he gets called in and fired from his job. Now, the rich man asks for a final accounting from this employee. He wants to see a spreadsheet of where everything stands, of who owes him what. So the manager's thrown into a crisis. He needs to make some quick decisions. He's lost his job as a bill collector for being dishonest, so it's unlikely that anyone else is going to hire him for an accountant. Tough for him to get a letter of recommendation in this situation. He also can't go get a labor job. He's not physically strong enough for anything like digging or bricklaying or anything that would take strength. He's not going to just go around begging. So he has this aha moment, this discovery moment. What he'll do is he'll offer to trim down the amounts owed by those in debt in the hopes that they will return the favor to him when he needs money or a place to stay. "I know what I'll do," he says in the story, "so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses." So he calls all the rich man's debtors into his office. We don't know how many debtors there were, but if you employ a full-time bill collector in your business, you probably have quite a few accounts. We don't witness every single one of these conversations or transactions, but we witness just two of them. The first guy who comes in owes the rich man 900 gallons of olive oil. "How about we cut that in half?" says the manager. "Now, I hope this helps you out," he says. "But just remember, I may need some help from you sometime soon." The second debtor who comes in owes the rich man 1,000 bushels of wheat. "How'd you like me to reduce that right now by 20%? Would that help you?" "I bet it would. And then maybe you can do something for me when I need it." Surprisingly, word of what this manager does gets back to the rich man. And when the rich man finds out what the manager has done, he praises him for it. He commends him for acting, and here's that word, shrewdly. So what was shrewd about it? Now notice, the rich man doesn't commend the manager for being ethical or honest or trustworthy. No one thinks that of this guy. He just gets commended for being shrewd or clever. Jesus then adds in his own voice at the end of the story, "I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself so that when it's gone, you too will be welcomed into eternal dwellings." Jesus says, you all should be more like this guy, more shrewd, more clever. It sure appears like Jesus is suggesting that we're to imitate the actions of this dishonest accounts receivable employee. But notice, Jesus doesn't pretend that the employee is a good person or righteous or truthful or trustworthy. There's no attempt to whitewash this scoundrel's character or what he does. Jesus just says, basically, this guy figured out how to disperse his employer's wealth in ways that would lead to a welcome for him into the homes of others. This guy was savvy about how to deal with money in a crisis. Now, I do want to point out one clue in the story that would be difficult to notice if you're reading from the New International Version, which is the translation that we use most of the time. Jesus urges us to use money, wealth, and possessions to prepare for what's next. If you're in a crisis, think strategically about what's coming. Be shrewd, be clever. But what he says is that we should aim at being welcomed into eternal dwellings. That's how the New International Version translates, eternal dwellings. That's not a very helpful translation. The Greek word here is the word for a flimsy, portable tent. You will be welcomed into tents. Okay? That makes a big difference. The manager aimed at finding a secure home. What Jesus promises us instead is the life proper to disciples or pilgrims. He promises us an abundant life, but one that might be in the long run simple, modest, and shared with lots of other people. He calls us to a life that's light, it's mobile, where we loosen our grip on possessions, we rethink how much we really need, so that we can put all of our trust in the God who always provides for us. In the teachings that follow that parable, Jesus emphasizes that the love of money, the love of wealth, the need for financial security, all of that can cause us to leave the good path. Now, it's important to let our financial lives express our deepest values. That's what Jesus is teaching. And that's true whether we have a little bit or we have a lot. What we do have in terms of our income, our savings, our assets, whatever benefits we have, our health care, and on, everything we have is a gift from God. And we are to be responsible stewards, caretakers who find joy in figuring out, being shrewd and clever in how widely we can disperse what we have. Our reading today from the Old Testament, from the crusty prophet Amos, reminds us that our economic lives have everything to do with our spiritual lives. The economy and the life of faith, these aren't two different compartments, two different categories. Jesus says in his teachings, we can't parcel out our deepest passion or our first loyalty. The only way to stay on the path is to put our full trust in the God who provides enough for everyone. You can't love, you can't serve both God and money. These teachings about the impossibility of dividing up our loyalties between God and money create a tension for all of us. It creates a tension for us as a congregation. In November, coming up this year, we will celebrate our 160th anniversary as a congregation. That's impressive. Founded in 1859. That's a lot of years to be any kind of an organization. That's an especially long time to be a faith community in the when you get into the 21st century. That's something to celebrate. Now, you don't last 160 years as a faith community without a long legacy of generous, committed people. The truth is, as a congregation, we have resources. We have resources to meet the operating budget as we head into each year. We have endowment funds that can fund our mission and fund our future because of the generous gifts of people both past and present. But I don't want us to rest on that or put our trust in that. What I want to do is encourage us as a congregation to keep practicing generosity. It's part of our tradition. It's in our DNA. I commended all of you last week for giving over $800 in a single offering for the Compassion Ministries led by our deacons. So friends, let's keep giving Let's keep giving it away. Because of privacy issues, we can't always share the details of how we live out our mission, how we share our mission money, how we share through our Hack Memorial Fund, and how our deacons help people who are in need. Just know that you are part of a congregation that's committed to meeting the basic needs of our neighbors and their real material struggles. That's part of our mission as a congregation. Now, from the community level, think on a personal level, today's teaching might prompt some questions that can move us all towards some healthy changes. Hearing the good news of living life Jesus' way always has the power, if we open ourselves to it, always has the power to free us from whatever's holding us captive. So I encourage you to take some time this week, in light of this gospel reading, to think and to pray. Journal if writing helps you process things. Talk with friends and family about things that matter to you. Sometimes just raising big questions, even to ourselves, can help let some new light in as we look to move in new ways forward. So some questions. Pick out one or two that's helpful and take it with you this week. When I take an honest look at my expenses, do they reflect the kind of person I want to become? Do my financial commitments express the values of a person who's learning to live life Jesus' way? Do they express the life of a person who's working to trust more in God? Do they look like the expenses of someone who's learning to live simply so that they can share more with other people? Have some of my financial decisions made me less free than I'd like to be? And if that's the case, can I make some changes? Are there things that I want to let go? Are there things that I could get rid of that would free me up? Am I so focused on having enough that I'm missing opportunities to be generous, to celebrate with other people, and to share with others? Am I avoiding an opportunity to experiment with something new in life because of my financial worries? And if that's the case, is there a way that I could live on less so that I can say yes to whatever this new opportunity might be? Parents and grandparents, let me ask you, are we modeling for our kids and for our grandkids the joy of a generous and simple life, free from the worries of getting, stockpiling, and comparing ourselves to others? Let's make sure we communicate to our young people, the young people that are here, the young people we're connected to throughout the rest of the week. Let's make sure we communicate to them that pursuing a career with a high salary, adopting a lifestyle just like everyone else has, that's not a very good strategy for becoming a happy person. The truth is, our young people might be happier doing something they love, living a simpler life with less stress. But we don't often tell them that. We at least ought to tell them that there are many different things that make up a rich and wonderful and meaningful life, and the kind of work you do and what you get paid for it. It's part of it, but it's a small part of it. You know, as I came into this week's sermon wrestling with how to talk about money and staying on the path, I'm reminded that scolding and shaming people never changes anyone's behavior in the long run. You can yell at people when they make mistakes. You can try to motivate them by pointing out what they've done wrong in the past. I often fall into this trap as a parent, and I do it sometimes as a pastor, but it never works. That never motivates people. That's not how people change. We change when we see something that's beautiful and we move towards that. We change when we see something that appeals to us in some deep way. We change when we know that making those changes will lead us on a path to joy and satisfaction. That's when we change. So the honest truth is, some of you are here today and you want a simpler life. You want a freer life. You want to worry less about money and wealth and possessions. You want a lighter, more mobile, more stress-free life. You want to be more open to the spontaneous things that God's Spirit may call you to do, ways you might be called to share. You want to be less attached to what you have. You want to be a better friend and a better neighbor. You want to share more, give more. do more things with others, do more things for other people. So, friends, let us put our trust in God. Let us open our hearts and our hands, and then see what happens. Amen.